York, this is Democracy Now.
I have no doubt that the events we're seeing around the world, things like Myanmar and Ethiopia, those are the opening chapters, because engagement-based ranking does two things. One, it prioritizes and amplifies divisive, polarizing, extreme content. And two, it concentrates it.
Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen testifies before the British Parliament as journalists dissect thousands of internal company documents she leaked showing how Facebook prioritizes profits over safety. We'll get the latest. Then we go to Sudan, where at least 10 protesters have been shot dead following a military coup.
This is a full-fledged coup, and we reject it completely. We have to go back to the constitutional document. The government should be handed to civilians, and you should free all those you detained and bring them back to their positions. General Abdel Fattah Burhan should submit his resignation. His resignation is the street's main demand.
And we look at how the tragic shooting death of cinematographer Helena Hutchins during a film shoot in New Mexico is drawing attention to cost-cutting decisions and overall safety in the film industry. Some of the unionized IATSE crew had walked off the set earlier in the day to protest working conditions.
I think one of the underlying factors was the crew walk off. Why did they walk off? It takes a lot for a film crew, especially a camera crew, to leave their director of photography.
We'll speak with the former head of an IATSE local. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Sudan, thousands of protesters have poured into the streets for a second straight day after the military ruler, General Abdel Fattah Burhan, declared a state of emergency, arresting Sudan's prime minister, most of his cabinet, and civilian members of a governing council. The coup comes 2 years after mass protests toppled Sudan's longtime leader, Omar al-Bashir. News outlets are reporting at least 10 protesters have been shot dead during today's protest demanding an end to military rule.
They fired stun grenades. Then they fired live ammunition. Two people died. I saw them with my own eyes. Then they came back twice and killed one more. This is the third one I saw.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned Monday's military coup and called for the immediate release of Sudan's prime minister and other detainees. In Washington, D.C., State Department spokesperson Ned Price said the U.S. would suspend a $700 million emergency aid package for Sudan. The coup occurred just a day after the U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, was in Khartoum, where he met with both the head of Sudan's military and the now-detained Sudanese prime minister. We'll have more on the coup in Sudan later in the broadcast. Moderna says that two smaller-sized doses of its COVID-19 vaccine produced a powerful immune response in children enrolled in a clinical trial and proved to be safe for people as young as 6 years old. Moderna has not yet publicly released its data, and the results are not yet peer-reviewed. Today, an FDA advisory committee meets to review Pfizer's application for emergency use of its COVID-19 vaccine for U.S. children age 5 to 11. Final approval from the CDC could come as soon as next week. The American Academy of Pediatrics reports about a quarter of all COVID-19 cases over the last week were among children, with over 118,000 infections in the United States. The Biden administration said Monday it'll soon end a ban on international travelers from 33 countries. Beginning November 8th, most travelers 18 and older will have to show proof of vaccination before boarding a flight to the U.S. Children will not need to prove vaccination, but will still need a negative test result. New York City's largest police union Monday asked a judge to suspend Mayor Bill de Blasio's vaccine mandate for municipal employees, arguing officers should have broader rights to claim a religious exemption. This follows an offer by Florida Republican Governor Ron DeSantis to hire police officers who were fired from their jobs in other states for refusing to get vaccinated. DeSantis is offering the officers $5,000 bonuses to relocate to Florida. The United Nations said Monday greenhouse gas levels hit a record high in 2020, with clear signs that nations are far off track from the Paris Climate Agreement's goal of limiting global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius. This is Petter Hytalas, head of the World Meteorological Organization.
We have again broken records in main three greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, methane and nitrous oxide. At the moment, we are heading towards 2.5 to 3 degrees warming rather than 1.5 to 2 degrees.
Meanwhile, a new report finds wealthy nations are falling well short of their pledge to mobilize $100 billion a year to help poorer nations adapt to the climate crisis. In South Sudan, over 700,000 people have been affected by torrential rains, which brought the region the worst flooding it's seen in over 60 years. A representative for the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights said climate change is to blame.
Climate change does not have to lead to despair, because there are solutions. Solutions include pumping, they include canalization, and they include good planning. What we would like to do as an international community, what we must do, is support the efforts of the people and the government of South Sudan.
In southern Italy, at least one person was killed Monday after a rare Mediterranean hurricane slammed into Sicily. The storm also brought severe flooding to Algeria and Tunisia. Just 2 months ago, Sicily recorded the highest temperature ever observed in Europe at nearly 120 degrees Fahrenheit. Here in the United States, record-setting October rainfall brought flooding to central and northern California, with Sacramento and San Francisco logging their wettest October days on record. The heavy rains will likely end fire season for much of California, but produced dangerous mudslides in recently burned areas. This comes as a severe weather pattern known as a bomb cyclone will bring excessive rainfall to parts of the northeastern U.S., with New York City set to receive a month's worth of rain in less than 48 hours. In related news, at least 33 climate justice advocates were arrested Monday after blocking two of New York City's main highways during morning rush hour. The act of civil disobedience called on President Biden to push for climate crisis provisions in the Build Back Better Act. In Spain, climate justice activists with Extinction Rebellion also held a protest Monday in central Madrid, demanding world leaders enact stronger action against the climate crisis. Protesters block traffic and chain themselves to barrels.
Greenhouse gas emissions are already causing climate catastrophes all over the planet. We do not have time. It is too late. If we do not join the action against everything that is happening, we will not arrive in time to save the planet.
In the Netherlands, Dutch pension fund giant ABP says it'll divest more than $17 billion in assets from fossil fuel companies ahead of the COP26 UN climate summit, which opens next week in Glasgow. ABP said as recently as June it would keep its fossil fuel investments, but reverse course amid widespread protests and legal challenges. In Britain, Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen testified before the British Parliament for more than 2 hours Monday, providing more damning evidence on how the social media giant prioritized profitability while allowing misinformation and violent and hateful content to spread on its platform. Haugen's testimony came as the United Kingdom and the European Union are both expected to introduce new digital and consumer protection measures.
You know, Mark Zuckerberg has unilateral control over 3 billion people, right? There's no will at the top to make sure these systems are run in an adequately safe way. And I think until we bring in a counterweight, things will be operated for the shareholders' interest and not for the public interest.
Frances Haugen turned over thousands of pages of internal Facebook documents to U.S. regulators, which are now the basis of a damning series of reports called the Facebook Papers that are being published this week. We'll have more on those revelations after headlines. In Guatemala, indigenous leaders are denouncing the government's enactment of a month-long 12-hour curfew and a ban on public gatherings in the northern coastal town of El Astor. In retaliation for protests against a nickel mining project, some 500 soldiers have also been deployed to the region. Indigenous communities say they were never consulted on plans for the massive mining project led by the Swiss-based Solway Investment Group. In recent days, Guatemalan police and military have violently repressed peaceful protests led by Maya Kekchi, especially indigenous communities, who say the mine would have catastrophic impacts on the land, water, and people. Amnesty International is closing its Hong Kong office by the end of the month, citing fears for the safety of staff working under a sweeping national security law imposed by Chinese authorities in Beijing. Amnesty's regional headquarters will close before year's end. In a statement, Amnesty International said Hong Kong's national security law has, quote, made it effectively impossible for human rights organizations in Hong Kong to work freely and without fear of serious reprisals from the government, they said. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has reversed plans to order the expulsion of 10 foreign ambassadors from NATO allies. The diplomatic row began after diplomats from the U.S. and its allies issued a joint statement urging the release of Turkish political prisoner Osman Kavala. Back in the United States, a new safety report released by the ride-hailing app Lyft is shedding light on an increasing number of sexual assaults during rides in recent years. Over 4,000 reports of sexual violence were made from 2017 to 19. At least 360 were reports of rape. The report also listed 10 deaths from physical assaults from 2017 to 2019. It's been 3 years since Lyft first pledged to disclose the information, along with its rival Uber, as both companies have come under fire over sexual violence and other serious safety problems. In Virginia, jury selection has begun in a federal civil trial that charges the organizers of the deadly white supremacist Unite the Right rally in 2017 with an unlawful conspiracy to commit violent acts. The lawsuit cites an 1871 law known as the Ku Klux Klan Act, which allows private citizens to sue other citizens for civil rights violations. And the White House has rejected former President Trump's latest claims of executive privilege again as he attempts to block the handing over of documents requested by the Congressional Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. Trump has already filed a lawsuit to stop the National Archives from releasing documents to Congress as part of the probe. The National Archives is set to begin turning over records to the U.S. House of Representatives next month, unless Trump wins a court order to block the request. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Thousands of pages of internal documents leaked by former Facebook product manager turned whistleblower Francis Haugen are now the basis of a damning series of reports called the Facebook Papers being published this week. They show how the company's choices prioritized profits over safety and how it tried to hide its own research from investors and the public. A new story published this morning by the Associated Press finds the Facebook documents show the platform ignored some of its own research suggestions for addressing vaccine misinformation. Facebook chief executive Mark Zuckerberg pushed back Monday during an earnings call with investors, calling the reports published, quote, coordinated effort to selectively use leaked documents to paint a false picture of our company, unquote. But fallout from the Facebook papers continues to generate political support for increased regulation. After testifying before Congress earlier this month, on Monday, Haugen testified for more than 2 hours before the British Parliament, as the United Kingdom and the European Union are both planning to introduce new digital and consumer protection measures. She spoke about the social harm generated when Facebook's platform is used to spread hate speech and incite violence without adequate content moderation in local languages, such as in Ethiopia, which is now engulfed by a civil war.
I think it is a grave danger to democracy and societies around the world to omit societal harm. To give like a core part of why I came forward was I looked at the consequences of choices Facebook was making, and I looked at things like the Global South, and I believe situations like Ethiopia are just part of the opening chapters of a novel that is going to be horrific to read, right? We have to care about societal harm, not just for the Global South, but our own societies, because like I said before, when an oil spill happens, it doesn't make it harder for us to regulate oil companies. But right now, Facebook is closing the door on us being able to act. Like, we have a slight window of time to regain people control over AI. We have to take advantage of this moment.
Frances Haugen's testimony comes as the news outlet The Verge reports Facebook plans to change its company name this week to reflect its transition from a social media company to being a, quote, metaverse company. Facebook has already announced plans to hire thousands of engineers to work in Europe on the metaverse. In the coming weeks, Haugen is scheduled to meet with officials in France, Germany, and the European Union. For more, we're joined by Ramesh Srinivasan, professor of information studies at the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA, where he also directs the Digital Cultures Lab. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, Professor. Can you talk about the significance of what has been released so far in the Facebook papers?
I think that it's great to be with you, Amy, and great to join you this morning. I think that what Frances Haugen has done is blow the whistle on Facebook's complicity and its internal knowledge of a number of problematic issues that many of us were alleging that they were engaging with for several years at this time. What Facebook has essentially done, and she has exposed that they were aware of, is play with our emotions, play with our psychologies, play with our anxieties. Those are the raw materials that fuels Facebook's attempts to be a digital empire. And more generally, this is an example of how this new form of digital capitalism that I believe Facebook is trailblazing is one that is playing with our intimate emotions on every single level. So, these revelations are extremely important right now. The timing is very, very important for action to be taken to rein Facebook in, but to also more generally understand that this is the general face of big tech that we're seeing more and more exposed in front of us.
And Professor, when Frances Haugen talks about greater people control over AI, what does that mean? What would that look like? And especially in view of the other issue that she raised, which is the disparate impact of these social media platforms on the global South, on less developed countries where Facebook is pouring far less resources into moderating its content.
Yeah, both are extremely important questions, Juan. I mean, first, to the point about people's relationship to AI, we tend to talk about AI these days as if it's some sort of Leviathan. But what we're actually talking about when we're discussing AI are the mechanisms by which various types of technology companies, mind you, which are the wealthiest companies in the history of the world, all of which are leveraging our lives, our public lives, our lives as citizens, even the internet that we paid for. It's basically the mechanism by which they're constantly surveilling us, they're constantly transacting our attention and our data, and they're playing with our psychological systems, our psychology, actually, in multiple ways. They're getting us into fight or flight mode to trigger and activate our attention and our arousal to keep us locked in and to therefore behaviorally manipulate us. They're also feeding us into groups that are increasingly hateful and divisive. We saw that with January 6th, for example. And the mechanism, the means by which they're able to do that is by playing again with our emotions, taking us to these groups so we can recognize falsely that we are not alone in having particular viewpoints, that there are others with more hardcore viewpoints. So now, if you look at those mechanisms of manipulation, of behavioral manipulation, which are actually quite common across big tech, but very specifically egregious in the case of Facebook, now let's look at that when it comes to the global South. The so-called global South, we're talking about the African continent, South America, South Asia, Southeast Asia, and so on, represent the vast majority of Facebook's users, because here we're talking about users not just of Facebook, the technology, but also platforms like WhatsApp and Instagram as well. Now, in many of these countries, there is not necessarily a strong independent media or a strong sort of journalistic press to rebut or to even actually provide some sort of counter visibility to all the hate and lies that Facebook prioritizes. Because we know, and Frances Haugen has confirmed this, that Facebook's algorithm prioritizes divisive, polarizing, and hateful content because of algorithmic and computational predictions that it will capture our attention. It will lock in our sympathetic nervous system. So if we look at these other countries in the world, we can see consistently, including right now at this very moment, when it comes to the Tigrayans, the Tigray people of Ethiopia, how hateful content is being prioritized. Facebook's algorithms tend to work very well with demagogue leaders who spew hateful content, and they tend to rebut the voices, as has always been the case over the last several years, of minorities, of indigenous peoples, of Muslims, and so on. So this has real life effects in terms of fomenting actual violence against people who are the most vulnerable in our world. And so this represents a profound, not negligence by Facebook, but they recognize they can get away with it. Simply hire a few exploited content moderators in places like the Philippines who are encountering PTSD, and then basically, you know, let the game play out in these countries in the world, which represent the vast majority, again, of Facebook's users.
And what is the impact of all of this on the democratic process? Because in reality, are we facing the possibility that through algorithms of companies like Facebook, we are actually clearly subverting the very process of people being able to democratically choose leadership and the government policies as a result of they're being inundated with a misinformation and hate?
I mean, that is absolutely what's occurring, because all of us, imagine if billions of us, and we're talking about approximately 3.5 or so billion people around the world with some access and engagement with Facebook technologies, recognizing that in many parts of the world, Facebook is actually the internet and WhatsApp is actually the cell phone network. So what this means is it's actually we are turning to Facebook to be our media company, our gateway to the world, and to be our space of democratic communication, when it is anything but that. Because imagine 3.5 billion people, all with their own screens that are actually unlocking them into a world that is not the, you know, public sphere in any sense at all, but is actually based upon polarization, amplification of hate, and more than anything, the sweet spot, the oil of the new economy, which is people's addiction and their attention. And there's nothing that gets our attention more than being put into fight or flight, getting outraged, getting angry, getting just sort of agonized. And that is exactly what Facebook is doing, because we're all being presented with completely different realities algorithmically on our screen. And those realities are not based on some open sense of dialogue or compassion or tolerance, but based on algorithmic extremism, based on all of this data that's being gathered about us, none of which we have any clue about.
So let's talk about examples. I mean, you're talking about the privatization of the global commons, because this is where so many people, even with the digital divide, communicate. I mean, you have the U.S. is 9% of the global population of Facebook, you know, the global consumers. So 90% are outside the United States, but 90% of the protections, or 90% of the resources going into dealing with the hate, are in the United States. Facebook is putting in the United States. And even here, look at what happens. Didn't Facebook set up a young woman, made pretend they were a young woman profile on Facebook, who said they supported Trump? Immediately, and this is Facebook, this is a fictional person, saw she was inundated with requests to join QAnon, with hate. And then we see what happened on January 6th. This is when the Facebook has poured in all of the so-called protections. Talk about its relation to January 6th, and then talk globally, where they're almost putting nothing in other languages, for example, in Vietnam.
It's such that's such an important example, Amy. Thank you for bringing it up. It's basically our mechanisms of sort of engaging with the wider world, even in our country, as you pointed out, even here in the United States, are all based upon routing us down these algorithmic, opaque rabbit holes that get us more and more extreme, right? Where content that is more extreme is often suggested to us. And it's often, as you alluded to, through the medium of a Facebook group, right? So any sort of group that has sort of hateful speech associated with it, you know, that expresses outrage, that will activate our emotions, because those are the raw materials of digital capitalism, our emotions and our anxieties and our feelings. That's exactly where they want to take us, because then that basically suggests to us, Amy, that you're not alone. There are other people with viewpoints not necessarily even just like your own, but even more amplified, more radical. So that ends up, as we saw, generating great amounts of violence and this brutal insurrection. So Facebook likes to claim that they are just supporting free speech, you know, that there are some bad actors gaining their platform, when in fact their platform is designed for bad actors to leverage their platform, because they have a highly symbiotic relationship, as we've spoken about in the past here on Democracy Now. The former president was perfectly symbiotic in his relationship with Facebook. They were very, very good bedfellows. And we see that with demagogues around the world. So now when we want to talk about the global South, we can recognize that Facebook can basically say, hey, you know, we're just, you know, we have different languages on our platform. Sure, you know, we are talking to a few people in countries like Ethiopia. We talk to a few people in Myanmar. Never mind that they were basically responsible in many ways in fomenting a genocide against the Rohingya. We are talking to people in the Modi government in India who has said many demagogic things against Muslim minorities. And the Facebook papers have revealed this, that Francis Haugen has brought out as well. This actually works very well for them. Here in the United States, where we have a strong enough or strongish independent media, thanks to Democracy Now!, we are able to challenge Facebook in the public sphere to some extent. But in other countries in the world, that doesn't necessarily exist to the same extent. And Facebook can basically say, hey, we can just leverage the lives, the daily lives, 24/7, 365 of billions of you, and basically do whatever we want. And, you know, they don't really have to do much about it. They don't have to actually take really any real steps to resolve the harms that they're causing to many people around the world.
And Professor, you mentioned India, the second largest population in the world. And the Facebook papers revealed that the Facebook had some of its managers had done a test of an average young adult in India, who became quickly flooded with Hindu nationalist propaganda and anti-Muslim hate. And one of the staffers who was monitoring this account said, quote, I've seen more images of dead people in the past 3 weeks than I've seen in my entire life total. Could you talk about the impact of the lack of accountability of Facebook in terms of what its platform is doing in a country like India?
And, you know, that hits home personally for me as someone of South Indian descent. I have been also part of WhatsApp groups with various, you know, friends or relatives in India that tend to spiral into, you know, going from a stereotype, for example, of a Muslim minority or an indigenous minority, and then quickly amplifying. And I think in a country like India, which is, you know, in a sense, the world's largest democracy, we see major threats to that democracy aligned with the Hindu nationalist government and also with the growth of Hindu nationalism, which, of course, as has always been the case, vilifies and victimizes and goes after the Muslim minority, which is just absurd and just makes my stomach churn. And this is exactly what you just laid out, Juan, is exactly how the Facebook playbook works. You create an account, you kind of browse around. I mean, we don't really browse anymore these days, but you sort of befriend various people, you look at various pages, and you quickly get suggested content that takes you down extremist rabbit holes. Because we all know, sadly, when we see pictures of dead people, when we see car crashes, when we see fires, we pay attention because it activates our sympathetic nervous system. Facebook recognizes the easiest way it can lock people in so it can monetize and manipulate them is by feeding them that type of content.
So finally, we just have 30 seconds, Ramesh, but I wanted to ask you about, you have Haugen now testifying before the British Parliament, going through Europe. Very significant because they're much more likely to regulate, which could be a model for the United States. Talk about the significance of this.
I think it's fantastic that the European Union and the UK want to take aggressive measures. Here in the United States, we have Section 230, which is protecting some of the liability of companies like Facebook from spreading misinformation and hate. We need to actually shift to think about a rights-based framework. You know, what are the rights we all have as people, as citizens, as peoples who are part of a democracy in a digital world? We need to deal with the algorithms associated with Facebook. There should be audit and oversight and disclosure. And more than anything, people need their privacy to be protected, because we know again and again, as we've discussed, vulnerable people get harmed. Real violence occurs against vulnerable peoples and polarizes and splinters our societies if we don't do anything
should
about
Facebook this. So let's shift. Or Meta, perhaps that's what it's going to be called, the announcement on Thursday, right. Should it simply be broken up like in the past, a century ago, Big Oil?
I think we may want to consider that Facebook is a public utility as well, and we should regulate it accordingly. But more than anything, we need to force them to give up power and put power in the hands of independent journalists, people in the human rights space, and more than anything, treat all of us who they are using, constantly using, as people who have sovereignty and rights. And they owe us true disclosure around what they know about us, and we should be opted out of surveillance capitalism as a default.
Ramesh Srinivasan, we want to thank you for being with us, professor of information studies at UCLA and Digital Cultures Lab director, author of the book Beyond the Valley, How Innovators Around the World Are Overcoming Inequality and Creating the Technologies of Tomorrow. When we come back, we go to Sudan, where at least 10 protesters have been shot dead following a military coup. Back in 30 seconds. Al-Sara and the Nubatones. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. A warning to our audience, this segment contains graphic video of state violence as we turn to Sudan, where protesters are back in the streets again today following Monday's military coup. News outlets are reporting at least 10 protesters have been shot dead since the military placed Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok under house arrest and detained most of his cabinet. A number of protest leaders have also been arrested. Sudan's military ruler, General Abdel Fattah Burhan, declared a state of emergency and dissolved a joint military-civilian governing council meant to transition Sudan to civilian rule. The coup comes 2 years after mass protests toppled Sudan's longtime leader, Omar al-Bashir. Protesters in Khartoum demanded an end to military rule.
This is a full-fledged coup, and we reject it completely. We have to go back to the constitutional document. The government should be handed to civilians, and you should free all those you detained and bring them back to their positions. General Abdel Fattah Burhan should submit his resignation. His resignation is the street's main demand.
Protesters accuse the military of firing live ammunition at the demonstrators on Monday.
They fired stun grenades. Then they fired live ammunition. Two people died. I saw them with my own eyes. Then they came back twice and killed one more. This is the third one I saw.
On Monday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the military coup in Sudan and called for the immediate release of Sudan's prime minister and the other detainees. United States has suspended $700 million in emergency aid package for Sudan. The coup occurred just a day after the U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, was in Khartoum, where he met with both the head of Sudan's military, who's fomenting the coup, and the now detained Sudanese prime minister. We're joined by two guests. Ismail Kouchkouch is a Sudanese-American journalist in Washington, D.C., former New York Times reporter who is based in East Africa, lived in Sudan for 8 years. But we're going first to Sudan, to Wallah Salah, a human rights lawyer who is based in Khartoum. Welcome to Democracy Now! Can you tell us what's happening on the ground? Wallah.
Yeah, sure.
Can you tell us what's happening on the ground in Khartoum right now? We understand at least 10 people have been killed by the military. Voila, can you hear me? Okay. Instead, we're
going. Okay.
Voila, can you hear me?
Yeah, sure.
It sounds like Voila is speaking to someone else right now. Voila, can you hear me? Why don't we go to her describing what is happening? We weren't sure if we could reach her in Khartoum, so just before the broadcast, we asked Voila Salah to describe what is happening over the last day.
By 6:30 a.m., I think I was on the street and I was trying to see what's going on. There were just people coming out of their houses, chanting, general devastation and anger in the faces of almost everyone I saw on the street, and a total rejection of the coup. The protests grew bigger by around 12. Just before the statement by General Burhan. By the afternoon, once the numbers grew and it became clear to everyone that this is a rejected move, no one wants it. I still wonder who the Transitional Military Council, who are they going to rule? Because as far as I know, walking around Khartoum city and seeing videos from other cities in the country, no one is support of this coup. No one is in support of this move. Almost everyone had an issue with the government, you know, but it never been, you know, the alternative to have the military rule. People wanted a different government with a different policies, but these are not military, because military rule is a regression. And I think that the past three years actually of a very dynamic political environment in the country, where people took the streets more than they went to schools and universities, it's became very clear that there are ways to connect from within the grassroots in the country. People, just citizens, are communicating with each other. The internet is out. Phone connection is very poor. I think one network is working. But still, people are going door to door, talking to each other, you know, encouraging each other to take the streets. What's going on in the city now, that almost every road and alley is blocked by a barricade that was put in by protesters. Very few cars are able to navigate, but mostly the movement is limited to same neighborhood. Bridges are closed. The borders between different cities are closed, so one cannot travel from Khartoum to other city, even if they don't need to cross a bridge. So every city is totally isolated, and this is clearly a move to isolate citizens. But the experience that people have developed in the past years, you know, remember that we didn't have social media between December and April 2018 to April 2019. And we didn't have internet totally for over 3 weeks after the massacre in June 2019. So people have developed not only the resilience, but also the skills of communication beyond technology.
That's Voila Salah, a human rights lawyer in Khartoum, describing to us what's taking place there. Ismail Kouchkouch is a Sudanese-American journalist who is based in Khartoum for years now in Washington, D.C. Can you take it from there, from what Voila described, and explain to a global audience exactly what has happened here?
So in 2018-2019... protests in Sudan brought down the government of Omar Bashir, the dictatorship of 30 years. That was followed by an agreement between civilian forces and the military to a power-sharing agreement that would last until 2023 that would see the transfer of power to a full civilian government and elections. The partnership between civilian forces and the military has been rocky, with new policies, with the pandemic. There is legitimate criticism of the performance of the transitional government, including the civilian side. But one question that has been on the minds of Sudanese since day one, since the fall of Bashir, is will Sudan be able to transfer into a truly full democracy? Given the experience of similar uprisings and revolutions in the region, that has been a great concern for many Sudanese. And we saw in the past weeks attempts for coup attempts, declared coup attempts. We saw protests in support of a military takeover, a sit-in in front of the Republican Palace in Khartoum. But we saw also massive, much larger protest in support of full civilian rule, despite the legitimate criticism of the transitional government, of civilians included. Most Sudanese are rejecting a return of the military, and that's what we're seeing right now.
And could you talk about the role of the other regional powers in terms of their relationship with the Sudanese military? I'm thinking specifically of Egypt or the UAE or Saudi Arabia, because obviously the United States openly has so far condemned this coup. But what's the role of these more local regional powers?
So up to now, we haven't seen any concrete evidence of a direct involvement of any of these regional powers. But given, the relationship that we know that the military has with the military in Egypt, with the Rapid Support Forces, which is a militia that turned into, was officialized and became a part of the military council, its relationship with governments in the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, its involvement in the war in Yemen. Given those relations, there's suspicion, legitimate suspicion, and legitimate questions. Are they directly involved in supporting this military takeover? The military takeover comes a day after U.S. Special Envoy met with members of the transitional government, both civilian and military. For the military to discount its meeting with the U.S. Special Envoy and whatever assistance, whatever promises, suggests, again, this is speculation, that it perhaps sees that it has other means for diplomatic and financial support. And these are the questions that people are raising.
So can you talk more about that? Can you talk about its relationship with the UAE, with Saudi Arabia, with Russia?
So we do know that the Rapid Support Forces has been involved in the war in Yemen, and it has a strong relationship with the United Arab Emirates. The Rapid Support Forces is basically a militia that has been made that comes out of the Janjaweed militia that fought in Darfur, that is responsible for crimes, and it became officialized a part of the Sudanese military apparatus and was basically lended to fight in Yemen. The Sudanese military, the official army, historically has had strong relationships with Egypt. Given the counter-revolutions that have occurred in the region, these are questions that people are raising. Are these governments involved in supporting this military takeover? We haven't seen any direct links or official statements on this, but I think these are legitimate questions people can ask.
Can you talk about the civilian prime minister, Hamdok, who was removed and arrested because he refused to support the coup? Does he have any popular backing at all, or is it just the population wants to maintain a civilian government, even though they may have criticisms of the existing officials of that government?
So Abdullah Hamdok, a former UN civil servant, has some support. Again, there are critiques of his performance during this transitional period of his government. But I think at heart, for most Sudanese, particularly the youth, after the 2019 revolution, is the important thing is to see the transfer into a full civilian government, to see elections. Keep in mind, this is after 30 years of authoritarian rule by the government of Omar al-Bashir. Hamdok was seen as a glimpse of hope. His expertise. Again, this is not to discount the critiques that people have had of the performance of his government, but the idea that we are setting back the clock after months of protests that brought down 30 years of authoritarian rule, that is something I think most Sudanese will just simply not accept.
Ismail, we just see that Army General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan spoke and said the ousted prime minister is being held, quote, at my residence for his own safety. If you can tell us who Burhan is he significant as an individual, and what his ties personally might be?
Abdel Fattah al-Burhan has been part of the military apparatus for some time. He is actually had been involved in the war in Darfur. He was part of the military that came to face or with the bringing down of al-Bashir in 2019. I think it's important to understand the delicate situation of the military apparatus in Sudan itself. So you have the army, the official army, and then you also have the rapid support forces. The Rapid Support Forces, as I mentioned, was a militia, basically the Janjaweed militia, that was made official. These are two components of the military apparatus in Sudan who do not necessarily like each other, but are in partnership and come together to be a part of the ruling Sovereignty Council. So there's this delicate dance, you can say, between the army led by Burhan and the Rapid Support Forces led by Mohamed Habdan Dalego Hameti. Hameti is the deputy of the Sovereignty Council. Now, with the changing of this government and the declaration that a new government will be established, I think that it will be interesting to see how this relationship plays out.
Very much for being with us.
And
one last question.
No, just in terms of the U.S. role, what do you see? The State Department has suspended $700 million in aid to Sudan. What do you see or you recommend that the U.S. government do in this situation?
Well, I think the most important thing is to keep eyes on Sudan. With the new cycle, attention might be, moved somewhere else. But I think Sudan's revolution of 2019 really brought not only hope to the country, but to the region, whether in the Middle East, North Africa, to the Horn of Africa. It was celebrated as one of the greatest examples of people power in recent times. It's important to pay attention to what is happening in Sudan. I do think that the Biden administration is paying more attention to the democratization process in Sudan. I think that if this was in the Trump administration, we would have seen something completely different. But I think keeping eyes on Sudan, I think is the key.
Ismail Kushkush, thanks so much for being with us. Sudanese American journalist who lived in Khartoum for years now, based in Washington, D.C. Coming up, we're going to look at the tragic shooting death of cinematographer Helena Hutchins during a film shoot in New Mexico, how it's drawing attention to cost-cutting decisions, overall safety in the film industry that almost brought IATSE to a strike. We'll talk with a former head of IATSE local. Stay with us.
Well, I'll be damned. Here comes your ghost again. But that's not unusual. It's just that the moon is full and you happen to call.
Diamonds and Rust by Joan Baez. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we look at the tragic shooting death of cinematographer Helena Hutchins during the filming of Rust last Thursday on a set in New Mexico. It's drawing attention to cost-cutting decisions and overall safety in the film industry. Yahoo News is reporting the gun that killed Helena had been used by crew members just hours beforehand for live ammunition target practice by some members of the crew who used the prop guns, including the gun that killed her, to shoot at beer cans, a practice often called plinking. The film's lead actor and producer is Alec Baldwin. He later shot the revolver after he was reportedly handed it by the first assistant director, David Halls, who told him it was a cold gun, meaning it was not loaded with live ammunition. A search warrant says Baldwin was reportedly rehearsing a scene for the film and, quote, pointing the revolver towards the camera lens when it hit Helena Hutchins and director Joel Souza. Meanwhile, prop maker Maggie Goal, a member of IATSE, that's the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, Local 44, told CNN she'd worked with the assistant director, Halls, in 2019 and said he failed to hold safety meetings or follow protocol when it came to announcing the presence of firearms on set. CNN also reported Halls was fired in 2019 from his position assistant director on the movie Freedom's Path after a gun unexpectedly discharged and injured a crew member. All this happened after some of the unionized IATSE below-the-line crew members had walked off the set of Rust earlier on the day Helena was killed to protest their housing, payment, and working conditions. A source told Yahoo News a walkout would usually shut down the film's production for a couple days. But New Mexico is a right-to-work state, so producers were able to hire non-union replacements and continue working on the film. A couple hours later, Helena was killed. For more, we're joined by Dutch Merrick. He's past president of IATSE Local 44, Hollywood Craftspersons in Altadena, California. He's been a prop master and armorer for over 25 years. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dutch. Thanks so much for getting in touch with us. So, you are an armorer, and you can explain what that is, and explain what you understand happened on this set, going to, in the context of these negotiations that IATSE is having nationwide, 60,000 members, partly around issues of safety, just like this.
Good morning, Amy. Thank you so much for having me. This is one symptom of an existential crisis in Hollywood. We handle firearms every single day. I work on big shows where we have machine guns firing, 10, 20 people firing machine guns at once, and it happens safely. We literally fire millions of blank rounds every year, and it's a very safe process. It's carefully regulated. We go through permits and training. The armorer handles the gun from a locked-up safe. They take it to the set. They're very careful about inspecting the weapons at all times and make sure they're clear, and they only load them just before we go. And only the armorer touches them. They hand them directly to the actor, and they get the scene. In this instance, the first assistant director was handling the gun. We're trying to figure out why that happened, and the guns clearly were mishandled and not locked up and allowed to use for actual gunfire shooting, which is, I've never heard of that in my 25 years in the business. It's unconscionable that you would take your movie guns and put live ammo in them ever. The camera crew walked off the morning of. because the conditions had become so deplorable. They had gone 3 weeks without a paycheck. They were having to work 14 plus hours a day with inadequate turnaround to get home. When I started in the business 25 years ago, I was putting in 12-hour days knowing that I was, you know, cutting my teeth in the business, and it would only get better from there. But it's only gotten worse. Our workers routinely face 16-plus hour days, day in and day out, putting in 80 to 100-hour weeks. And the producers only have to pay a minor penalty if they want to work our crews through lunch. That penalty hasn't risen in ages. So often shows now, to satiate the growing hunger of for entertainment and increasing quality and to produce it in a shorter time, they're pushing our workers to work straight through lunch and work entire days, and they pay them a minor penalty, and it's grinding our workers to the bone. And with this contract that's come up, every worker that I've talked to, with few exceptions, is not happy with it.
But Dutch, I wanted to ask you precisely about that, the impact of the growth of streaming videos from companies like Netflix and Hulu and Apple. What has been the impact on the working conditions as a result of basically this vast commodification of more and more video production?
Yeah, the hunger, you know, the pandemic put into high relief that people not only they don't wait for 7 o'clock on Thursday night to see Seinfeld once a week. They get a show they like and they binge watch 13 episodes in a sitting. So there's a voracious appetite for content that Netflix and Amazon and Hulu and others are feeding. So the competition is fiercer than ever. We have trouble finding enough crew to populate these shows, just to fill the jobs. Finding trucks and equipment and stages. Everything is overbooked. So we're literally in overdrive to fulfill the need. When Netflix was buying existing content and recycling old series, that was one thing. But now they're creating brand new content. And we're grateful for the work, but we're frankly getting worked to death to just meet the demands.
So,
Yeah, I wanted to ask something else, though. This issue of Alec Baldwin firing the gun, although a lot of the emphasis has been away from Baldwin, but I think 101 of gun use is that even if you believe a gun is not loaded, you don't point it in the direction of live people. Could you talk about that? What are the rules of using guns for actors as well as other crew members?
Yeah, one of my jobs as an armorer is when I hand an actor a gun, I arrange with that actor where they're going to point the gun. The three basic rules of gun safety that we teach are always keep your finger off the trigger until you're ready to fire. You point the gun at a safe direction, never at a person, and you always treat the gun as if it's loaded. From what I've heard, the armorer was not present during this sequence. My guess is, from what I understand, they're coming back from lunch. There may have been a rush for them to get back to rehearsing. I imagine it was a pretty jarring day having much of the crew walk off and other people come in to replace them. So there was likely a bit of mayhem. And Alec Baldwin, I can't speak to what was going on with him, but I'll offer you this. The job of the prop person, the armorer, and the costumers and everybody is to create a safe space where the actor can just focus on their role and what the lines and getting into that space. So we sort of keep them in an envelope, but a bit of a bubble. And I think an actor generally learns to grow trust with the crew. All right, you're handing me something that's safe. I mean, I'm guessing they got into a rhythm. He may not have noticed there was no armor there. Okay, here's the gun. Great. And what are we going to do? And he went through the process. It's hard for me to speak to exactly what happened, but it's easy to imagine that he had fallen into a level of trust with the crew around him. And that first assistant director did a major no-no and he grabbed a gun off a cart and just handed it to him. And I can imagine that first assistant director in two conflicting roles. One, he's the bottom line safety officer for the entire production. And he's the one that's trying to get things done on schedule and get the ball moving.
Helena Hutchins, who was killed when the crew walked off that morning, said she felt like she was losing her best friends. Well, they certainly lost their best friend. Helena is the mother of a 10-year-old and leaves a husband as well in Hollywood. Do you think that the set should have shut down when these workers walked off? And do you think this could affect the final negotiation? We have 10 seconds around the big IATSE contract and the vote.
Our hearts go out to Helene and her family and the entire crew. They absolutely should have shut down that day. It was a disaster waiting to happen. The recipe was there for a tragedy.
We have to leave it there, Dutch. Thanks so much for being with us, Dutch Merrick. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.